The number one resolution for people last year was to save more money, but nearly half gave up by February. Don't let that be you. Download Rocket Money to reach your financial goals this year. Track your spending, cut waste, and automate savings in one simple app. Rocket Money shows you all your expenses and categorizes them, so you know exactly where your money's going and where you're overspending. From there, the app cuts waste by canceling your unused subscriptions and lowering your bills. No customer service needed. With that money freed up, the app will automatically set some cash aside for your goals. Whether it's an emergency fund, paying off debt, or saving for vacation, Rocket Money's got you covered. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. And on average, users can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Make saving money a priority this year. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Welcome back to Pod Save the World. I'm Tommy Vitor.
I'm Ben Rhodes.
Ben Rhodes, all the way live from his childhood bedroom. But this time, as a New York Times bestseller again, congratulations.
I got to thank all the worlders out there. Thanks so much. It feels like this book came out about a year ago, but it's only been a couple weeks. We clocked in at number three on the combined New York Times bestseller list, which is great.
I'm a little pissed that O'Reilly was a spot ahead of you. I think there's still time for the worlders to remedy that.
I was going to say, if people thought we were harping too much on Bill O'Reilly, like came in right after him. He was number two, killing the mob. Congrats to Clint Smith for taking out the king there, taking the first slot. We were just behind Bill O'Reilly.
We got time. Also, it hurt. At the end of the show today, we're going to have an excerpt from Ben's audiobook. So stick around for that at the end of the show. Also, yeah, Ben, I'm so glad you mentioned Clint Smith's book, How the Word Is Passed. It was number one on the list. Just a thought for listeners. So Juneteenth is coming up on June 19th. There's a chapter in Clint's book where he goes to Galveston, Texas, where Juneteenth originated. He participates in this Juneteenth ceremony. It's really like one of the most moving parts of the book. It helped me better understand the holiday itself. So I highly, highly recommend it. And also just like credit to him. He's part of the Crooked Media family and just like an unbelievably good guy. I love talking to him a couple weeks
ago. Honored to be behind that guy. Not happy to be behind Bill O'Reilly, but hey, I can't complain.
Yes. Well, look, next time that list comes out, O'Reilly's going to be way behind both of you. We have an amazing show today, Ben. We have Joe Biden's first foreign trip. And what the media wants us to believe is a huge showdown with Vladimir Putin. So we'll learn about that. We get to say, bye-bye, Bibi Netanyahu. That makes my heart grow two sizes. There's already a new prime minister in government in Israel. We have threats against K-pop. Some great news about efforts to eradicate a horrible disease. And then we'll end by having some fun, by making fun of two of the biggest assholes on the international stage. We'll make the world does here wait to see who it is. And then I talked with Yair Rosenberg from Tablet Magazine. He's going to help all of us understand who is in this new Israeli government, what it means for the U.S., what it means for the Palestinian people. He's just the nicest guy, so smart, knows everything about what's going on, and it really helped me. One quick plug, Ben, in addition to everyone who needs to buy your book if they haven't already. This week on Pod Save the People, DeRay and the crew talk all about the history and the importance of Juneteenth. Pod Save the People is a fantastic show every week. It is essential listening this week. So subscribe and listen to Pod Save the People wherever you get your podcasts. Ben, Joe Biden is abroad as we speak on his first foreign trip. That is, it's been exciting to watch. It's bringing back some fun memories of how brutal those things are.
They were my favorite part of the job, as hard as they were. And so I have to admit, like it was kind of I haven't felt much FOMO this entire time, but it's great to see like America with a bunch of decent people who are trying to do the right thing, representing them on the world stage. So it's been good. It's been good to watch, and it's brought back all kinds of memories too.
Yeah, and the reception was as good as you thought it would be. So Biden had meetings with the G7 leaders in the UK. He hung out with Queen Elizabeth at Windsor Castle. He went to Brussels to meet with the NATO alliance and European Union leadership. And he had a one-on-one with President Erdogan of Turkey. We record this on Tuesday afternoon. On Wednesday, Biden is going to meet with Vladimir Putin. So Ben, I think we maybe just take this in reverse chronological order and start with this Putin meeting in Geneva. It was interesting to me at Biden's press conference yesterday where he said that all these NATO leaders he talked to were actually happy that he's meeting with Putin. I think the conventional wisdom going in was maybe they'd be upset. The last time a U.S. president met with Putin was in 2018, which was the disaster in Helsinki that we all remember with Donald Trump. So the U.S. media is just completely obsessed with this meeting. The first three questions at Biden's post-NATO press conference were about the Putin meeting. All of them were multiple parts, so I guess you could call it six questions. Time magazine put Biden and Putin on the cover, which would have been a huge deal in 1998. The issues the issues they'll talk about are obviously important, right? Like hacking, Ukraine, arms control. The question, I guess, is like, what can you reasonably expect him to accomplish in a meeting? The Biden team is lowering expectations, including in your very excellent interview with John Finer last week. Like, what do you think is the best case outcome for the meeting? And then, like, I don't know, how do you build on it afterwards?
I mean, we talked to Finer last week about just, first of all, why are they having a meeting? And I think their judgment coming in was probably that, you know, Russia had done a whole bunch of shit to us, the SolarWinds attack, the interference in our election. They detained Navalny. That's not to us, but that's something we don't like. And then Biden had done a whole bunch of sanctions in response. And I think they wanted the meeting to kind of test whether they could just stop this spiral where it felt like we were on the precipice of like ever escalating cyber wars and trading sanctions and the rest of it. I think, unfortunately, like even since they announced the meeting, Putin's pretty much indicated that he's not going to change. You had the Belarus airliner diverted, which the Russians were clearly involved in. You've had more ransomware attacks, you know, reportedly from within Russia. You've had Putin doing media tours where he, like, you know, echoes right-wing talking points about Joe Biden being old and January 6th being like a hang at the Capitol. So I think, like, look, the best case scenario is that there's a symbolic value in the American president being seen to kind of stand up to Vladimir Putin and deliver a bunch of tough messages on a bunch of stuff. It kind of puts the final period on the America's backstage for the Biden foreign policy. I think there are some areas where they might, you know, want to at least explore, can we make some progress? They want to keep a border open into Syria to provide humanitarian aid to refugees and displaced people there. And the Russians can block that. They want to start some kind of discussion around arms control and nuclear weapons that kind of fell by the wayside under Trump. They very much want to enlist the Russians into some discussion about nations being responsible for stopping ransomware and cyber attacks from within their borders. Putin is obviously going to resist that, but they want to at least get a dialogue going. They want the Russians to be constructive in trying to get back into the Iran nuclear deal. So there's stuff where like they could come out of this with some cooperation, but like it's not going to change the fundamental negative orientation of U.S.-Russian relations. It's not going to change Vladimir Putin's behavior after 20 years. I mean, part of what's difficult about all this media hype is that, you know, it sets up that this is going to be some sea change when it's not. It's going to be
right.
You know, a chance for these two guys to sit face to face and tell each other what they think and hopefully, you know, prevent worse outcomes. But I don't think you're going to see some dramatic breakthrough or some dramatic, you know, fight. It's not going to be like a punch up at the summit, you know? So
yeah,
I think even though we're taping this before, I think we have a pretty good idea where it's headed.
Yeah, I think you're right. And also, like, reinvigorating the NATO alliance is going to be, you know, maybe the most important part of Biden's approach to Russia. I saw, you know, the narrative going into some of these NATO meetings was that maybe a bunch of countries were pissed off about Biden's decision to pull all U.S. troops out of Afghanistan in September. I didn't see a ton of that in the post-summit cover, to be honest. Like you said earlier, like Biden clearly benefited from the contrast with Trump, who went into the last summit calling NATO obsolete. He refused to mention Article 5 in his first NATO speech, which is like the crux of the entire thing. It's the whole deal. He berated them about defense spending, right? So the two major storylines I saw coming out of NATO were, one, NATO's first real recognition that China's military and cyber capabilities now pose a threat. And two, there was briefly some confusion about whether Ukraine had been formally admitted into NATO. Yeah. That was wrong. Biden made clear in his press conference that no, nothing had changed. Ukraine still needs to meet a bunch of criteria around the corruption and rule of law and professionalizing its military before they can be admitted. Ukrainian President Zelensky expressed some, I think, fair frustration at that process and said he just like wants a yes or a no. So Ben, two questions. One, how significant do you think this China piece is, like China being mentioned in this NATO communique? And then two, given the fact that Russia and Ukraine are like literally in a low-grade war as we speak and have been for years, does the international community really think it's a good idea to admit Ukraine into NATO right now if we are going to affirm Article 5 of the NATO Charter, which says an attack on one is an attack on all?
Yeah. I mean, look, first of all, like the sequencing of this is very intentional, right? Like go to the UK, you're meeting with like the core beating heart of the democratic world. And then you're going to NATO and meeting with like the bigger security alliance of the democratic world. And then with all this backup, you're going to go in and deliver these messages to Putin. On the Ukraine thing, so people know the background, Ukraine and Georgia were offered what's called membership action plans during the Bush administration. And this was even then seen as quite provocative. You know, three Baltic republics, Lithuania, Estonia, and Latvia, that had been a part of the former Soviet Union, had already come into NATO. And these were two countries that, you know, were clearly going to be provocative in terms of extending this invite vis-a-vis Russia. I don't need to tell you that because since those membership action plans were offered, Russia has invaded and occupied parts of both of those countries. Yeah. Clearly, like an animating force of everything about Vladimir Putin has basically been these two countries are not going to go into NATO. And I think that the awkward truth here, no matter how much you care about Ukrainian sovereignty, and we should, and Ukraine's ability to choose its own relationships, is it, Article 5 says an attack on one is an attack on all, and you have to mean it. You know, if suddenly you're taking in countries where, you know, you're not sure if you'd go to war to defend them, the whole purpose of the alliance collapses. And let's face it, do Americans want to go into World War III? I mean, Russia's in Ukraine right now. The logic of them being in NATO is that we would go to war with Russia because they're there. And so this is the awkward dance that Biden has to act like we're still open to this. But I think commonsensically people know like this is not happening anytime soon, you know, but you don't want to kind of totally withdraw it because you don't want to look like you're caving to the Russians. But you also don't want Zelensky to be out there saying, oh, yeah, it's all done. We're coming into NATO. So we've got to be careful about this. You know, it's a difficult balancing act. The China thing, look, I think it was important that at the G7 China was on the agenda. I think at NATO, it's important for them to kind of be noting it as they kind of did in the communique as something that the alliance is going to have to think about. But like, I'm a little wary of like saying to NATO, okay, now like we're out of Afghanistan, we're dealing with the Russians over here, but now we're going to like get ready for the next conflict with China. Let's take one step at a time here. Like we got to get out of Afghanistan. We got to fortify Europe and Eastern European security in the face of Russia. We got to think about cyber challenges. Yeah. We got to think about the Mediterranean and the Aegean, where there's a lot of activity related to counterterrorism. And so I introducing China is something that is discussed at NATO summits. I think it makes sense, but the idea that like NATO is going to be patrolling the South China Sea here, like let's calm down there too, you know? So like, I think that what the Biden team is trying to do is shape the agenda for all these institutions going forward. Like these are going to be things that we need to talk about. And I think that's right. I wouldn't over crank the China piece.
Yeah, I think that's well put. So we'll close with the G7. So on Monday's Pod Save America, we talked a bit about the frustration from activists that G7 countries didn't do more to commit to helping developing countries get COVID vaccines and you know, do more on climate change, specifically hastening the transition away from coal-fired power plants. So, you know, given the urgency of both those problems, I think it's obviously fair to want more. I bet Biden's team agrees, and they're really focused, you know, when it comes to climate on that big next climate change summit in November. Ben, like, I think Brexit was hanging over the entire summit. Biden and apparently President Macron of France pushed Boris Johnson really hard on issues around Brexit in Northern Ireland. The UK itself is struggling to reopen because of an uptick in COVID cases. Again, like the change in tone really did help gloss over, I think, a lot of the substantive challenges. But what did you make of the G7? Like success, failure, TBD?
So I thought the most interesting thing is I mentioned this when Biden gave his speech to Congress, when he shifted to foreign policy, like he didn't mention terrorism for a while. Huh. I was struck by just the agenda of the G7 was a totally different agenda than anyone we've seen before. The agenda was COVID. It was climate change. It was China. It was democracy. It was anti-corruption. All these things that, you know, we've been talking about on this podcast for a few years, like that is now what the agenda is for the world's democracies. And that is important and new to have the U.S. kind of emphasizing that set of issues. I mean, we obviously did some of this in the Obama years, but I mean, you really didn't see the Middle East and terrorism front and center in the ways that that has been the case in the past. I think that's good. And that's a space to watch. That means the U.S. and all these multilateral institutions is kind of going to be focused on a post 9/11 foreign policy for really the first time. I think on the scale, the ambition, like people are right to push. I think on each one, part of this is it's early days. I think on climate, the Europeans are like, well, what are you guys really going to do, you Americans? Yeah. Like we have, I mean, we're back, you know, as we keep saying and hearing, but like, what is our bill going to be that passes through Congress? Like the biggest thing America can do to reduce our emissions in the near term is pass the most ambitious climate bill possible. And, you know, it's not clear whether that stuff is going to get sacrificed on the altar of bipartisanship. You know, so I think it's just going to take until that summit in Glasgow later in the year before we know kind of how ambitious the U.S. can be with our target, which is part of how we get other nations to be more ambitious.
Right.
I do think the Biden team is going to have to deliver. They've raised a lot of expectations that we're going to lead the fight against vaccine inequity, against climate change, and kind of promoting a global foreign policy for the middle class, like minimum taxation. A lot of these things are commitments without, you know, the substance behind them yet. That's to be expected when it's June of your first year in office. But I mean, they've kind of set the report card for themselves. Like, are they going to be able to elevate the ambition on climate? Are they going to be able to elevate the ambition in getting rid of coal? Are they going to be able to elevate the global minimum tax? And we'll see. And I mean, we should be rooting for that.
Yeah, totally rooting for it. It was good to see that, you know, I think Pew Research did a poll of 12 foreign countries. And in some of them, you know, America's favorability was up by as much as 30 points. But the flip side of that was majorities, and I think all of the countries surveyed, or at least most of them, expressed concern about the state of America's democracy itself. So no surprise there to why. Ben, this is old news now, but did you see the story about the cicadas swarming the engine of the press charter and delaying their departure time?
I did. That press charter is the subject of more drama.
It's so cursed.
It was cursed on our first foreign trip. Wasn't it grounded for days by a malfunction or something?
Yes. So like, just so everyone knows, like a lot of the foreign trips, right? You have reporters on Air Force One. That's the pool. It's a smaller group. Then the White House charters a separate plane to take the rest of the press corps like ahead. I was often manifested on that plane. And it means you get up at god awful times, you land hours and hours early and just like sit there and wait. And, you know, sometimes it can work out in your favor. Like that time you just mentioned, Ben, the plane broke down and we got stuck in Istanbul for like an extra day. So I got to do Hagia Sophia, the Blue Mosque, like all the cool things. Another time we had to kill, I think, 10 hours at the W Hotel in Bali while you guys were all still at the summit at the end of a long swing.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
You know, it cuts both ways.
Yeah. I'm going to do a very quick explainer, Tommy, on something in your wheelhouse, which is why all these questions at the press conferences are so annoyingly the same, right? Because you, like you said, it's like three or four questions in a row that's the same question about Putin. And it's because they often call on the TV reporters, all of whom want to be seen on television asking like, do you think he's a killer? You know? And so they're repeating these questions in ways that is super annoying given how much other stuff there's to talk about. That said, as frustrated as I would be by the dominance of the Putin coverage if I was in the White House, if you put a big old Putin summit at the end of your trip, like you're going to get a lot of people asking these questions.
Yeah, that's exactly right. All right, we are going to shift gears to our friend Bibi Netanyahu. I'm a little upset to see, Ben, that there is just a breaking news alert that Israel is launching airstrikes into Gaza, according to Palestinian security sources. So maybe we'll be able to track that as we go here. But that's very bad news. But let's stick to the good news. So at long last, Bibi Netanyahu is no longer the prime minister of Israel. He was prime minister for 15 years, including the last 12 in a row. Now he's just another racist, corrupt, authoritarian member of parliament, and that's a good thing. Yeah. On Sunday night, the Knesset voted in the new government by a single vote, 60 to 59. It was so close that one lawmaker had to leave her hospital bed, vote, and then go back to the hospital. Netanyahu supporters decided to go out in the most obnoxious, childish way possible. They heckled the new prime minister, Naftali Bennett, during his speech. Netanyahu himself delivered a speech where he pledged to, quote, lead you in a daily battle against this bad and dangerous left-wing government and bring it down, end quote. He also bragged about giving the finger to the United States, saying, the Biden administration asked me not to make our disagreements on the Iran nuclear deal public. With all due respect to President Biden, I refused. He then compared returning to the Iran nuclear deal to the decision by FDR not to bomb the train tracks that led to Auschwitz in 1944. Mm. Just a truly disgusting and offensive comparison, and one that makes me just pissed off all over again at the big brains in Washington who say the United States can't ever criticize Bibi Netanyahu publicly when he's like comparing the JCPOA yeah. to the Holocaust. Anyway, Ben, I know I shouldn't gloat because
that's some loud, intense diplomacy there.
That's some loud. That's what I will try not to gloat. I'm already gloating. This thing's fragile. Bibi is like the monster at the end of a horror movie. He comes back. But like yeah. any parting thoughts, any parting words for Mr. Netanyahu? And we'll talk much more about the new government coalition in my interview with Yair Rosenberg. So stick around for that.
I mean, the takeaways it offered that I think are slightly different than what I've said before about this creep. You know, one, vigilance is required. Like he's still there in the same way that yeah. Trump is still there. Like in the same way that he's become even more radicalized on the way out, just like Trump did with all of his batshit crazy allegations and offensive remarks. Number two, like I think it's interesting how, you know, looking at the full scale and breadth of this opposition, it made me realize like this is a tactic we're seeing in more and more countries. Like in Hungary, you know, which I obviously write about in my book, like the entire opposition put this big umbrella over them, you know, mm-hmm. from a former far right party to the Socialist Party to some kind of centrist parties.
Yeah.
Because they're like, you know what? We all agree we have to get rid of this guy and then yep. we can fight it out amongst ourselves. And I think that's a very healthy tactic and it's necessary. Yeah. It's, by the way, the same thing kind of the Democratic Party did here. It's not like
AOC endorsing Joe Biden.
Yeah, yeah you know? Exactly. Right. So I think lesson to be learned, right. Remain vigilant, but you know, unify as an opposition to get rid of the corrupt autocrat. I'll be watching like whether he's convicted. I mean, I think that like part of the hope of this new government is that like Bibi can actually be convicted of all the yep. crimes he's been indicted for. And then that might more permanently settle things in terms of his role in Israeli politics. I think the Republican Party's kind of full blending together with Bibiism and the Likud Party in Israel was like fully completed for me when I saw like Nikki Haley like tweeting out photos with like that nut job evangelical preacher guy, John Hagee, and Bibi calling him Prime Minister Netanyahu, even though he's no longer Prime Minister, in his residence, which she. I don't know how he's still like hanging out in the prime minister's residence.
Yeah.
So like the Republican Party's embrace of this, again, this is garbage. The guy on the way out the door bragged about bashing the Democratic president, who was very careful to say he would never criticize Bibi publicly. Like let's be able to criticize a government that does things that we disagree with at times. And if these reports about Gaza are true, I mean, it's a sign that nothing really changed for the Palestinians. And you even saw this new government approve a far right like protest march through Jerusalem, not really protest, kind of incitement march, basically. So, you know, the Hamas had said they would respond to that. Hopefully cooler heads prevail and hopefully the need to have consensus in this government moderates it to some extent. But yes, let's enjoy Bibi Netanyahu being gone, recognize that a lot of people worked very hard against long odds to accomplish at least that. And then we can enjoy that and then hope Israelis take the next step.
Yeah, agreed. And Yair had, you know, like a not at all naive, but like hopeful take on how things could get better, how you could see more Arab participation in politics, a more moderate coalition than what anything you'd see under Netanyahu. So we'll see. And obviously we'll be tracking this news. Ben, let's turn to Nigeria, because on June 4th, the Nigerian Ministry of Information announced that the government had suspended Twitter operations in the country after Twitter froze Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari's account and deleted one of his tweets that was interpreted by many as a threat of genocide against an ethnic group. that seems like a very good reason to delete a tweet. Twitter has been an important tool for activists in Nigeria who want to raise awareness about issues like police brutality. They want to organize protests. They want to connect with each other. So this suspension is really a big deal for them. And they could now be prosecuted if they, you know, use a VPN and find some way to tweet, which many of them are doing. Because our former president is a selfish arsonist, he decided to weigh in on this matter on his sad little website. And he congratulated Nigeria for banning Twitter. He also encouraged other countries to ban Twitter and Facebook for, quote, not allowing free and open speech. All voices should be heard. Then, if irony wasn't dead, I would point out the irony of a ban on social media for not allowing free speech. But alas, irony has been dead since 2016, so I will not. Yeah. So Trump also called these two American companies, Facebook and Twitter, evil. He said he might have banned them too, except, quote, Zuckerberg kept calling me and coming to the White House for dinner, telling me how great I was. 2024, question mark? Anyway, Ben, do you think
that I believe.
That I do believe too.
Yeah, that I totally believe.
So two questions for you. Do you think this kind of ban is tenable in Nigeria? And like, what's the impact, do you think, of a former president of the United States cheerleading a crackdown on free speech and activists like this?
Well, I think what's most dangerous, to take the second one, is that, you know, Trump and these guys like who rail against Twitter, and we saw Modi kind of harassing Twitter and Facebook as well. They don't do it because they think they're getting a raw deal. They do it because they know they're getting the best deal possible, which is guys like Trump and Modi, you know, can flood Twitter with their trolls and disinformation, and then charge that you're stifling free speech if you like remove something that is promoting an insurrection in this country or a genocide in Nigeria.
Why about cancel culture?
They're not doing that because they actually believe free speech is being constrained. They're doing that to intimidate these platforms from taking any stand against the kind of authoritarian garbage and disinformation flood that like runs across these platforms. And so I think Trump contributing to that kind of global normalization of the idea that the authoritarians get to choose what free speech is, and the platforms have to accept that reality, and the rest of us just have to live in a world in which, you know, a whole swath of society is being like, you know, spoon-fed, mainlined garbage. Like, that's bad. That I think Nigeria taking this step too, it's not, you know, Nigeria is the biggest country in Africa. It's kind of a bellwether. So part of what you worry about is both discourse in Nigeria, but also other countries kind of following suit. At the end of the day though, and this is something we'll have to pull the thread on, you know, over the course of the year, Tommy, on this podcast, like these platforms are going to have to make choices at a certain point. Like, are they actually going to police certain types of content on their platforms? In which case they probably will be kicked out of certain countries. Mm-hmm. Or are they going to kind of allow their platforms to be manipulated like this? And I have to say, like, at the end of the day, at some point, they're going to have to get to a place where they lose some market access because they're actually trying to do the right thing. I would also hope that, you know, taking away Twitter in a massive country like Nigeria with a huge discourse creates some pressures from within Nigeria for them to restore Twitter, because like that can't be a particularly popular thing either. So like some of these battles are going to be fought within countries. Some of these battles are going to be fought between the platforms and governments. But I think the basic principle has to be, we are for free and open debate, but there's certain kinds of incitement and certain kinds of disinformation that has clearly been incredibly corrosive to democracy everywhere and to like a healthy functioning societies everywhere. And I'd rather see the platform start to take that on than just kind of fold whenever they get brushed back by an authoritarian or a kind of quasi-authoritarian, in this case, leader.
Yeah, I mean, especially something that was viewed as a threat of genocide against an ethnic group. I mean, we saw what happened when that kind of content was allowed to stay up in Myanmar. There were literally devastating consequences. Many people died, really horrible outcomes. Okay, some exciting news for you, Ben. So some very rare, very good disease-related news for you after a year of pandemic. So scientists in Indonesia, they figured out a way to drastically reduce the transmission of dengue fever by infecting mosquitoes with a bacteria that then prevents the mosquitoes from getting infected by the dengue virus. I will not pretend for 1 second to understand how this works. But the results of a trial in a city in Indonesia reduced the incidence of dengue among humans by 77%, which is enormous success. The World Health Organization describes dengue fever as one of the top 10 threats to global health, and it infects an estimated 390 million people every year. There's also evidence that this method could work against the Zika virus. It could work against yellow fever. So it truly could be a game changer and turn the mosquito from like a lethal human killing machine to just like an annoying pain in the ass when there's one in your room. So just great news.
Yeah. And look, dengue fever sucks. I've never had it, but I know a bunch of people who have, including people who got it on White House trips that we took to places like Southeast Asia. It really messes you up. It can really slow you down. It can really sap your energy. And that leads to the point that, like, not only is this great for health, but in some nations, it's like a productivity issue, right?
Yeah, it's like a really people, economic issue. Yeah.
It's an economic issue because, like, there's such crippling dengue fever, and that has such an impact on people's capacity. If you're talking about like an agricultural economy or, you know, like people having to put in a hard day's work, like when they can't with dengue fever. And it also shows, like, I hope that one of the things that, as we're looking at the G7 and pumping money into pandemic preparedness, just investing globally in health security, which is something we began during the Obama administration. But like, we should be finding ways, even as we're arguing about like the origins of COVID, like to be working with the World Health Organization, working with groups of other countries, investing in ways to cure these diseases, because the positive impact, not just in lives saved, but economic productivity and quality of life, is so, the upside is so high. And I think what we've seen, look at our own vaccine effort, like just surging some resources to get to that vaccine, like got it much faster than people thought. Like if we put that kind of concerted effort and resourcing globally into fighting a whole range of these diseases, like a lot of good can come out of that effort.
Yes. Yes. Imagine if we had another 2, 3, 4 years until we had a vaccine. It's, I can't even imagine it. It's too awful. Super quick update. So last week, Ben and I talked about the election that was happening in Peru. It was a socialist first-time candidate against this corrupt right-wing former like first lady candidate. So with nearly all the results in, Pedro Castillo, the socialist candidate, has won. So congrats to him. Congrats to the people of Peru. The very hard governing choices come next, but just wanted to give everybody a quick update on that one.
Yeah, and it'd be, you know, fascinating to see like someone elected on a pretty far left platform, in basically a 50-50 country. And his initial comments, he's kind of tried to thread the needle, like saying reassuring things like, I'm not going to upend the entire system, while also saying he's going to transform Peru. And so be interesting to watch how he does, you know, but it's again, further sign of the things moving left down there. And also, you know, watch how democracy, you know, how resilient democracy has improved going forward too.
Yes. Okay. This is a little worse news. Kim Jong-un is coming for pop culture again.
This pisses me off so much. Yeah.
This time it's K-pop. I know, man. First of all, K-pop is powerful, so he better watch his ass. But yeah. Kim Jong-un, he called it a vicious cancer. He said it's corrupting the attire, hairstyles, and speeches and behavior of young North Koreans. The New York Times reported that in recent months, Kim has ranted about South Korean movies and music like almost every day. Last year, North Korea passed a law that could get you 5 to 15 years in a forced labor camp if you're caught with like South Korean media videos, you know, thumb drives with shows on it, whatever. Ben, here's my question for you. He sounds a little scared here. Do the Scorpions need to record a song in Korean? Are we like a K-pop Wind of Change away from reunifying the peninsula?
It goes to show, right? Like that what he knows is that, you know, people, Koreans love K-pop. I'm sure that includes North Koreans as well as South Koreans. And like the, you know, I've always believed that in these circumstances of like just diametrically opposed political systems and foreign policy, like the biggest vulnerability is often cultural. Because people are like looking at K-pop and they're like, well, that looks like a pretty good deal over there.
Yeah.
What is the society and political model that allowed them to create that? You know? And it's not about nuclear weapons. It's not about America. It's just about like, hey, these are other Koreans like doing this incredible thing that is totally changing global culture that I want to be a part of. Right.
Yeah.
And you would think that, yeah, that would make Kim Jong-un a little nervous. Because if you've seen the North Korean kind of film industry, you know, like Kim Jong-un on horseback, let's just say that's not going to hit it with the demo.
No.
As well as like BTS's, you know?
No, it's not. Yeah, like jokes aside, I mean, the fact that people are willing to risk 15 years in a forced labor camp to watch a movie is a real indication of the power of art and culture. It's also an interesting story, I think, about the degree to which a totalitarian state can control what its public consumes in 2021, right? Like China is trying to do this through these incredibly high-tech means. North Korea is going old school and they're just trying to ban stuff. But this New York Times piece, it noted that a lot of North Korean propaganda describes South Korea as like a hellhole full of people begging on the streets, like searching for food.
Yeah.
But if you watch these like South Korean, I guess, soap opera type things, like North Koreans were learning about how people in South Korea were going on diets to get in shape at a time when there was a famine in the north. So it really does like puncture the whole system.
Yeah, no, when I was in government, I heard like I was constantly trying to figure out like, what can we learn more about what the hell is happening in North Korea? And one of the things I learned, Tommy, is like, these DVDs would get smuggled into North Korea, these South Korean soap operas. Again, not by us. I'm not saying like just, you know, because like people want the content. And the thing that blew people's minds was like, what, look at these nice apartments they're living in. Like Seoul looks like that. It wasn't that they were that into soap operas, that they were like, they've been told about how much more impoverished the South Koreans were than them. And they just see these people in like nice apartments. And if you take it to K-pop, I mean, you're seeing people like, happy, like expressing themselves like freely in every way, shape or form. If it's a video, like you're seeing them like out in the club or something.
Yeah, dancing.
To me, this is like the longer term vulnerability to the North Koreans. Now the Chinese are trying to like perfect some capacity to have certain culture get in and to be so sophisticated they can block certain things. But given the proximity of South Korea to North Korea, and given the fact that K-pop is kind of the number one global music phenomena, I think he's going to have a hard time keeping that out.
Yeah, good luck with that, pal. I don't think it's going to work. So two last stories. I promised to, we're going to spend a little time dunking on assholes. So we've talked about Jair Bolsonaro before, the president of Brazil. He's an idiot. He's a right-wing authoritarian. So for some reason, he decided to board a plane to greet some of his supporters. Now, it turns out the people that liked him were sitting up front in first class in the more expensive area, but the folks in back and coach were not quite as happy to see President Bolsonaro. Here's what it sounded like.
I mean, like, you know, this guy, like, it's all these fucking guys like Bolsonaro who put themselves out as like these populists, the man of the people, like bullshit, you know, like, you know, you've got like, you're the man of some people who are assholes and then some rich people who like, you know, you take care of because you're corrupt. But like most people feel like the people in coach did like, get the fuck off the plane, man. Like you screwed things up here.
I wish we had the video. Obviously it's a podcast. We can't. One woman was literally flipping him the bird and yelling, get out Bolsonaro, genocidal maniac. Like nobody's pulling punches anymore. They're not scared of this guy.
No, that's the thing. And Brazilians, like, don't mess with Brazilians. Like,
no, they're, it's an intense political culture. Okay, last segment. This one's just a little bit of a loss in translation. So I think Pod Save the World listeners know that Mike Pompeo was a terrible Secretary of State, but they may not know that he is also just embarrassingly bad on Twitter. So today he tweeted the following. Calling all unapologetic Americans to join me and become a pipe hitter. P-I-P-E-H-I-T-T-E-R. Most of the world who responded to his tweet seemed to think that was a very surprising reference to crack.
Was that a 420? Was that a 420?
Yeah. I don't know what he was talking about. Mike Pompeo seems to think it means proud to be an American. I don't know, Ben. Maybe the solution is Mike needs to log off and go away and just not be part of our political system ever again. I don't know. That's an idea.
At some point, somebody somewhere is going to have to explain to me the appeal of this man to anybody. I mean, he's clearly like, he's like nails on a chalkboard, difficult to physically look at and listen to because he's so smug and arrogant in all of his presentation. This is a man who's so arrogant that like his like formal slogan for the State Department was like swagger, you know?
Yes.
Which not exactly like quiet and intense diplomacy, you know.
No.
but like it's also not exactly like kind of the ethos of the Foreign Service, right?
No.
And but also like he's like, we've talked about this, but like, where is the constituency? Who are the pipe hitters? Who are the Pompeo pipe hitters? Like, who are they? Like, describe to me who is like standing Mike Pompeo. I mean, like maybe the staff at FDD, like the foreign funded anti-Iran deal think tank crowd in DC. Like, if that's your whole constituency for running for president of the United States, like, good luck taking that out for a swing. But apparently, like the pipe hitters, like, you know, will have their chance.
I just would love to have just get my hands on the email chain of the approval process. It's like, yeah, Mike, tweet out the pipe hitter thing. That's a real winner. Okay, when we come back, we will have my interview with Yair Rosenberg. We're going to talk about the new Israeli coalition, what it means for U.S.-Israeli relations, what it means for the Palestinian people. So stick around for that. I am so excited to welcome to the show Yair Rosenberg. He is a senior writer at Tablet Magazine. He covers the intersection of politics, culture, and religion. He also has a fantastic Substack that you should check out. It's yair.substack.com. Yair is a very hot name right now, Y-A-I-R. You should all learn about it. It's having a renaissance. But it's just a great site. It's a fantastic resource. And he's one of the people I turn to when I'm trying to figure out what the hell is going on in Israeli politics. So Yair, thanks so much for doing the show.
My pleasure.
So, Yair, I feel like I DM you frequently. We've been talking for years now, often about Bibi Netanyahu. He's no longer the prime minister. I think that is, objectively great news for me, for the Israeli people, in my opinion, for the U.S., I think for the world. There's a lot of questions about how this coalition that replaced him will work. There's some concern that the new prime minister, Naftali Bennett, is just as right-wing as Bibi Netanyahu on key issues. He's said some really abhorrent things about the Palestinian people in the past. He has been a leader of the settler movement. He's been opposed to a two-state solution. Given that context and sort of given the broader coalition that's now in place, how do you think people should be thinking about like the basic political orientation of this new government as a whole?
Yeah. So to answer that, we got to take like a quick step back just to understand how we even got here, which is that, Israel, people may remember, had, four elections in 2 years.
Can you believe
and
it?
This was the result of Israel having two different conflicting things going on. One was an anti-Netanyahu majority in terms of the voting public, but then none of the anti-Netanyahu majority could actually agree on anything else other than the fact that they wanted Netanyahu gone. So you had all these anti-Netanyahu parties that disagreed on everything from socialism to capitalism to LGBT rights, right to the Palestinians. And so you had an election after election where Netanyahu didn't have enough people to create a new government, but the opposition couldn't get its act together to create their own. And what changed is that Yair Lapid, the Israeli opposition leader this time around, but not in previous rounds, managed to actually get everyone together and on the same page and form some sort of crazy coalition, left, right, center, settlers, Arabs, socialists, capitalists, they're all in it. And basically just in order to push Netanyahu out of office and put a new government into office. But of course, now, as you said, you end up with this government that's quite Frankensteinian. It doesn't seem to agree on anything other than Netanyahu, and Netanyahu's gone. And in order to make it work, in order to sort of get some right-wing parties to join this coalition along with everybody else, the center and the left and the Arabs, Lapid, even though he had the most seats in the coalition, had to give the first 2 years of the prime ministership out of four to Naftali Bennett, right? This guy who's a former head of the umbrella settler body in Israel, who is an indoctrinaire right-wing nationalist, religious nationalist, someone who has advocated for a very long time annexing, say, 60% of the West Bank. And that was in order to basically create the coalition in the first place. But they basically put in a whole bunch of rules to basically make it impossible for Bennett to actually do most of the things that he would have done if he was prime minister with actually the power, say, that Netanyahu had. So basically, both Bennett and Lapid have vetoes on everything in the coalition. So literally nothing can get done unless they both agree. So obviously no annexation of the West Bank is going to happen. Bennett has acknowledged this. He says, we're going to have to defer a lot of our dreams and just focus on governing on the things that people agree upon. And at the same time, you're unlikely to see dramatic steps on, say, a two-state solution, because Bennett's probably going to say, I don't want to see that either. And so what you're starting to see from this government, at least on this front, on the Palestinian front, is discussions of ways to sort of shrink the points of friction with the Palestinians, right? Ways to sort of shrink the points of friction with the Biden administration, with Democrats in you know, and generally with the international community, with the Europeans, right? Saying that Netanyahu pursued a very confrontational policy on all of these fronts. And we're going to start taking into account the input that other actors give us. We're not always going to agree, but we're going to try to end up somewhere else. And we're going to try. So you're not going to see some sort of, I mean, never say never with the Middle East. I don't want to have a soundbite where I look like a total idiot. But you know, it seems unlikely that in the next, you know, 4 years, you're going to see some massive dramatic shifts. But what you won't see is also the sorts of things that Bibi was playing with, which is say like, we're going to annex the West Bank, which is right. something he toyed with for quite some time. Yeah, so that's sort of the very, very small nutshell, but there's so much more that one could discuss about this coalition.
Well, yeah, no, look, I have a lot more questions for you. Look, and also, you know, sound bites where you look like a total idiot are my bread and butter, so please don't insult them on this show. So you mentioned like three of these power brokers, right? There's Naftali Bennett, there's Yair Lapid, and then there's Mansour Abbas. You talked a bit about Bennett. So who is Yair Lapid? Like, and why have you called him like the real power broker in this coalition?
Yeah. So Yair Lapid got 17 seats in the most recent Israeli election. Bennett got 7. Right? That's a very big difference. Not only that, Yair Lapid basically ran the entire electoral strategy for the anti-Bibi bloc. He went out and did this very weird thing where he said, we have enough seats. My party is going to do well enough in the election, right? If you want to vote for other left-wing parties or center parties or center-right parties that are anti-Netanyahu, please do that. Don't try to make my party bigger because that actually won't help, right? We need to get all these other parties into the Knesset. And if they got too few seats, they wouldn't have made it in, right? The Arab party that's in the Knesset just barely got in, the one that's in the new government. And Lapid basically came up with that. He masterminded that, and it succeeded. And so you have the leftist Socialist Merits Party in, and you have the center-left Labor Party in, and you have Mansour Abbas's Ram Arab Party in, and all of these smaller parties that made it possible to build this component coalition. And he's the one who negotiated it. I mean, Bennett didn't sit down and like try to get all these people to sign on paper and figure out what everybody needed to be able to sign on to something. That was Lapid's job. And quite frankly, every time something big comes up that this coalition is going to do, Lapid is going to have to do the same thing again. He's going to have to go and canvass everybody and try to get everybody on the same page, right? And do this all over again. It's a very tough job. I wrote that when he was first starting at the beginning of May, he got the mandate to try to form a government. I said, if Lapid manages to solve the Rubik's Cube of Israeli politics, it will be one of the most remarkable feats in Israeli political history and the beginning of his problems, right? Because now the hard work begins, right? How do you actually get these people to productively govern? Now, there are things they can do. They can pass a budget, right? With the compromises that one does in budget wrangling. Netanyahu couldn't do that. In fact, that's what brought down his government. They will be able to make reforms on things like religion and state, because although there's a lot of distinctions between these different parties, there are no ultra-Orthodox religious parties, Jewish religious parties, in this coalition for the first time in quite some time. And that will enable the government to liberalize things like kosher certification, it liberalized things like who can pray at the Western Wall. This is not as big a deal, perhaps, to the general listener here, but to American Jews, it has been a very big goal to be able to have, for example, an egalitarian prayer space where men and women can pray together at the Western Wall rather than a men's section and a women's section, and that's just your choices. And the ultra-Orthodox religious parties kept that status quo in place, and Netanyahu gave it to them. And this new coalition will reform a bunch of things on religion and state. It will reform things on the budget. It will do some other things that couldn't be done because of who Netanyahu was sort of in league with in his own coalition. It also will, as we referenced earlier, it will be able to have a more productive relationship with potentially with an American administration, including a Democratic administration. Because although they, for example, disagree with the Iran deal, they have absolutely no desire to blow up the U.S.-Israel relationship over it. They want to sort of be a constructive player at the table and say, okay, can we try to like make the deal a little bit better by our lights, right? We recognize that this is basically a fait accompli, right? And since this is going to happen, right, can we try to make it work better for everyone, including us? Mm-hmm. Which is, of course, what Obama wanted to do with Netanyahu, but Netanyahu did not want to do. But both Lapid and Bennett, yes, famously so. I mean, and it's like, whereas Lapid and Bennett, that's what they want to do. Now, Bibi, as we may discuss, wants to sort of salt the earth and make that hard for that to happen.
So yeah, I want to ask you about that.
Yeah.
Like, I too was hopeful to see Yair Lapid say that he really wants to revive Israel's relationship with the Democratic Party, which, you know, speaks to sort of the history of the U.S.-Israeli relationship, which has been more bipartisan. Before we get into Bibi trying to burn the house down on the way out, Mansour Abbas, the leader of the Ram Islamist Party. Can you tell us about his background and how he ended up a part of this coalition? He seems to be an incredibly savvy political actor.
Yeah, so it's very interesting. And also, you know, quite frankly, it's one of those sort of media failures where basically I hope, and I assume this is happening now, every international paper is prepping a giant profile on Mansour Abbas. Because this is an Arab politician in Israel who is now about to become the most powerful. He is now the most powerful Arab politician in Israeli history. And he did it by making a sort of audacious bet, which was that he was going to run explicitly on the platform of, we will actually be part of, in some way, the next Israeli government. And that could be, he said, it could be right wing. He was coy about it. It could be right wing, it could be left wing. The point is, who offers us the most? Mm-hmm. And in the past, the way it worked with Israel's Arab parties is that they were non-Zionist or anti-Zionist, and the Israeli Jewish parties were Zionist, meaning believe in the Jewish state, whereas these other parties are either not going to affirm a Jewish state or actively against it. And they all basically had this estrangement of convenience, where the Zionists didn't want to serve with the non-Zionist Arab parties, and the non-Zionist Arab parties didn't want to serve with the Zionist parties. And it worked out somewhat well for everybody to sort of posture this way the entire time. But, you know, the people who lost, of course, were Israel's Arab citizens who didn't have representation in Israeli coalitions.
Right.
And Abbas said, I'm going to try something different. I'm going to say that I will join. People actually thought what he would do is he would support a government from outside the coalition, which means he would sometimes give them their votes to keep them in power, but he wouldn't be part of the coalition. He and Lapid then surprised everyone and actually for the first time brought the party into the coalition, which is something that's never happened in Israeli politics before. And in exchange, Abbas secured a bunch of guarantees, a lot of funding for the Arab community in Israel. Those citizens who go by Arab Israeli, some go by Palestinian citizens of Israel. There are different terms that they accept. He ensured the freezing of certain laws that were basically used to demolish unauthorized construction by Arabs in various parts of Israel that basically were basically being, you know, enforced mostly against Arab communities and not necessarily against Jewish communities. And he got them to freeze that law for years. And hopefully he wants to reform it. We'll see if that happens. So different things like that. But the idea is that for the first time there is an Arab player in Israeli politics, somebody who is on the nightly news, who is speaking for that community, and also someone who is delivering for that community explicitly. And this can have some real reverberations in the future in Israeli politics, because if you look at the history of turnout in Israel, the Arab turnout traditionally lags behind the overall general population turnout, which is mostly Jewish. And that makes perfect sense, because if you don't think your party's actually going to serve in a coalition, it's not that big a deal to vote. It's more of a protest thing.
Right.
But a lot of people turned out to vote for Mansour Abbas. And a lot of people, a lot of Arabs polled in Israel now say they actually want their politicians to play ball and serve in Israeli governments. And if they start seeing that happening and they start getting deliverables from a democratic system, well, then more of them may turn out. And then you might start to see the percentage of Arab votes tick up towards the percentage of Jewish votes. And that creates more seats in the Knesset. It's literally a mathematical thing. There are many more people voting. More seats exist now that are being supported by people who are more inclined towards a centrist or left-wing alliance, or towards a right-wing alliance that is willing to take seriously the needs of the Arab community in Israel.
Yeah.
And so that's one of the high stakes that Mansour Abbas is playing with. Right now, he looks like he's achieved it. I should give you a little bit of background. Where does this guy come from? So he's the head of this party called Ram, which is one of several Arab parties in Israel. It's a conservative religious party. In order to make some of the compromises he did to get into the coalition, he actually had to consult with a religious council to get approval for things. This is like one of these like only in Israel things. There are also Jewish ultra-Orthodox religious parties that do a similar thing. And they gave him their blessing to do things like this. He comes out of something called the Islamic movement, which in Israel, which is what it sounds like, which is a religious movement that spreads Islam. But it has basically a division between a northern branch and a southern branch. The northern branch has been entangled with various different factions that are associated with terrorism and Hamas, right? But the southern branch is much more conciliatory and seeks change and reform within the democratic process. They condemn Holocaust denial. They support a two-state solution. And Mansour Abbas comes out of that stream. And that's basically the role that he's been playing now, what he's been like part of this coalition. He's been speaking out against, you know, sort of racism in Israeli society and bigotry and saying things that don't bring us together are things that we shouldn't be doing, which actually dovetails a lot with the sort of things that Lapid is saying. So you can see how they, in the end, got along. One of the interesting things Abbas said was that he was courted by Netanyahu. Netanyahu offered him the moon also to try to get him into his coalition. It didn't work for two reasons. One was that the racist party that Netanyahu also midwifed into the Knesset turned to Netanyahu and said, no, what part of the, you know, our manifesto did you not understand? We are racist. We will not sit with an Arab party in the government. So Netanyahu couldn't get them both to sit there. But the second reason was that Abbas said, yeah, I think Netanyahu offered me a little more than the coalition, the current coalition, but I didn't believe he'd give it to me, whereas these guys I trust, right? I think these guys will actually deliver. Yeah. And Lapid knows that he has to deliver, I think, for the Arab community in Israel if he wants to maintain this alliance.
Yeah, hoisted by your own petard, Bibi. Well, I mean, look, that future prospect you described there of a more diverse, more representative government is really an exciting one. But let's talk about Bibi. So there was this vote on Sunday. You know, Ben and I talked a bit about it earlier. It was unbelievably acrimonious. You had members of parliament who are Netanyahu allies booing Naftali Bennett. Yair Lapid ended up not giving a speech because he said he didn't want to embarrass his 86-year-old mother who had traveled down for this event. You know, people were getting ejected from the room. It was a mess. And then Bibi Netanyahu gave this speech where he just sort of like burned down the place, talked about all the times he gave the middle finger to the United States and told American presidents, specifically Barack Obama, to go fuck himself, which, you know, to me, reinforced all the reasons why I think that American presidents should be willing to criticize Netanyahu. But I digress. But so Netanyahu's not going anywhere, right? He's still a member of parliament. He's going to try to claw his way back into power. What did you make of this scene and this closing message about like sticking it to the Americans and blah, blah, blah? I mean, is that an effective message in Israeli politics?
That remains to be seen. I don't actually think that particular message is. I do think, yeah, that's something that's really important to underscore that, again, as we've been saying over and over, Israel, unlike America, is a parliamentary democracy. That's why you have to, like when Netanyahu loses, he doesn't just go away, right? He becomes the leader of the opposition. And that's a very powerful bully pulpit in its own right. He is a political leader now, still in Israel. He is just a different political leader. You know, when foreign dignitaries come, they're going to visit him too.
Yeah.
And just like, you know, you to understand the current coalition, it's a parliamentary democracy. It's a coalition. And so you can look at the guy who's in the front, like Bennett, but you really got to look at all the people behind it, right? And those are like center and left-wing ministers. And that tells you what Bennett's freedom of action is.
Mm-hmm.
But to return to Netanyahu, he definitely was trying to salt the earth between the American government and the new Israeli government, because it would actually be quite bad for him if they started getting along better, because he said that what's necessary is the sort of partisan caustic of approach that he's taken, and that I did this because it was necessary for Israel's security and its survival and so on. And if it turns out that that's not true, right, mm-hmm. and it turns out that these countries can get along and they can compromise a little bit, right, and the sky does not fall, right, that's a real, rebuke to Bibiism. And so he doesn't want that to happen. Something else that I wonder if we'll see him try to do is also see him try to salt the earth between the new government and the Republican Party, which has been very closely identified with Netanyahu, particularly during the Trump years. And they're seeing their guy go out of power. And so what does he, you know, what message does he send to them? Does he say, well, you know, you need to support Israel no matter what government is in power and you should like work with this current government? Or does Netanyahu say, well, you know, they're going to be gone soon. I'll figure out a way to topple this government. It's pretty fractious already. And then I'll be back, right? So, you know, they're kind of pretenders. Don't really pay attention to them. And again, being pro-Bibi is being pro-Israel, right? That sort of message, right? And it's going to be interesting to see which of those messages resonates more, whether it's being pro-Israel means being pro who's in power and who the Israelis have chosen, right? Versus being pro-Israel is being pro-Bibi, which of those Republican stakeholders choose?
Yeah.
And we've seen both, right? We've seen some, you know, Republicans already start congratulating the new government and saying, we look forward to working with you. And then we'll see people like Matt Gaetz tweeting that, you know, this whole government is just united by Bibi hate and they're going to, you know, persecute Netanyahu, but he's going to be back because they don't have anything holding them together, which is something we should probably talk about, right? Will this government stick around with all this fractious stuff, right? So we're going to see that break, I think, in the Republican Party. It'll be interesting to see how it shakes out.
Yeah, Matt Gaetz is probably should worry about his own prosecution and not allege that this government is going to try to railroad Netanyahu. What there are all these corruption cases against Bibi Netanyahu. And by the way, like on this broader point of like trying to drive a wedge between the U.S. and Israel, I was struck by Netanyahu's tone as compared to Yair Lapid. I mean, I do think that like Republicans and Democrats are when they talk about the U.S. commitment to Israel, they really do mean the country, and they don't mean to the man, Bibi Netanyahu, unless you're currently living at Mar-a-Lago. But I don't know. I this is not a bet I would take if I were Netanyahu, but I digress. So the corruption cases, Bibi, you know, he tried to pass all these legislation to protect himself from prosecution. It seemed like maybe one of the reasons he was clinging to power so desperately. Does his ouster from the prime ministership change the process or the timeline for any of these cases at all? Like, how does that all work?
Yeah, so Israel has an independent judiciary. The cases of the system. And basically, there is nothing that anyone's going to do to affect it. It's going to move at the pace it's going to move. There's a tremendous amount of documentation because there are multiple cases. There's like years and years of investigative materials. And Bibi has very good lawyers who are vetting everything and squeezing it within an inch of its life. So this thing can drag out for years. Which is also part of Netanyahu's hope, because he's like, okay, so this is a setback for me, but if I can get this government to fall, I can always come back into power, and then we're back to where we were. And so this is far from his perspective, and I don't think he's wrong, this is far from over. And it's also why, if you look, Netanyahu did a lot to sort of delegitimize this government and attack its bona fides. But in the end, he handed over power. He did not try to, you know, January 6 it. He was asked walking out of parliament the other after Bennett was sworn in by a reporter, right? Will there be a peaceful transfer of power? Will you meet with Bennett? And he like looked at this guy and he said, no, there's going to be a revolution, right? And then he just stopped. He's like, what an idiotic question.
Yeah, right?
And then
he just walked away,
right? And it's like really, like, he's like, I'm not trying to like burn this country down, but that's because of course Netanyahu wants to rule the country, right? He doesn't want to destroy it. And this is a difference. There are many analogies one can make, and I've made them, right, between, say, someone like Trump and Netanyahu, American politics, Israeli politics. But, you know, Netanyahu, in the end, this is the difference between Trump, you know, a man-child narcissist who cares about no one but himself, and Netanyahu, like many other right-wing populists, who has a vision for his country and a definition of success that he's actually working towards. And that makes him so much more of a formidable politician in various ways.
Yeah.
And so Netanyahu still plans to come back and to pursue that vision, and he sees this as a setback. But he doesn't see this as the end. And he's running, you know, the opposition right now. And he's going to try to pick apart this coalition, hit every pressure point that he possibly can, and try to make it collapse as soon as he can make it collapse. Because in parliamentary democracies, if you can't put together 61 seats to keep your government in power, right, in the case of Israel, which has 120 seats in parliament, right, you can no longer govern. And then we're back to elections again. And then Netanyahu can try to win one.
Yeah, yeah. Well, so right before we started recording, you know, I saw these videos of far right Israelis marching through East Jerusalem in this annual parade that had been delayed. Some of them were chanting death to Arabs. Some of them were chanting the villages should be burned. I mean, again, this thing was supposed to happen last month, but it got pushed because of the tense situation in Sheikh Jarrah. And then, you know, because Hamas rocket fire. But like clearly this parade, this kind of language is incitement, you know. It's incitement happening in the light of day with journalists filming it and the police aren't shutting it down. There's real concern about another flare up of tensions like we saw in Sheikh Jarrah or more rocket fire from Hamas. I mean, look, I don't think you or I have all that much hope that a Naftali Bennett led government is going to lead to two states or a Palestinian state, even though as much as we hope it would. But do you have any hope that this new administration is willing or able to try to like keep a lid on this kind of activity and make day-to-day life better for the Palestinian people? Because I think that goal just, you know, gets lost in these conversations. And look, that's on me for asking you a million questions about the U.S.-Israeli relationship. But like that is the backdrop behind all the tensions we saw last month and the fighting and the death toll and something I think we all would love to prevent.
Yeah, it's not something that goes away just because people are no longer shooting rockets or dropping bombs from airplanes. And it's important to continue to think about that and to focus on it. And hopefully the Biden administration, that's something that now they realize they can engage upon with the new government. So when you see something like that march, I think it's really instructive to look at it because this is a march that was supposed to happen and that didn't happen, but they purposely rescheduled it and they basically ended up doing it right when this new government came in. They chanted racist chants. Not everyone there, this is important, right? Of course, right? There are a variety of people at this march, but there are always racists at this march. And the organizers not only tolerate them, they basically look the other way, if not sympathize with them.
And it was really awful to see how many young kids were chanting this stuff. You know, yeah. I mean, it's horrible to see a 15-year-old boy chanting death to Arabs. It's just, you know.
Exactly.
It's depressing.
And so you have this sort of thing going on, and it's purposely happening right now. And they're also holding up signs that say Naftali Bennett is a traitor, right? This guy who was a right-wing politician until two minutes ago. And what it is people ask, like, how can you have that? And at the exact same time, just install the first Israeli government with an Arab party in it. Right. As though, you know, and people say that seems like a contradiction. But of course it's not. And I think it should be understandable to us in America why it's not, which is that whenever you have a push towards more integration, you are absolutely going to have a racist backlash. And those two things go together. And these people wanted to have their march, and they weren't going to let it be postponed. And especially after this new government came in, and especially after Naftali Bennett decided, right, who they thought was their guy, said, I'm going to make a government with Arabs in it. Right. So now they feel betrayed. Right. And they feel like the people are, you know, that the stars are aligning against them. And so they get that much louder. Right. And they get that much angrier. And I think we're going to see more of this sort of back and forth. And part of it is going to make someone like Naftali Bennett have to choose. Right. And he's going to look at this and say, you know, are you with Mansour Abbas and the people in your coalition, right, who built this thing together that is built, right? If you look at their speeches, they really said, we want to build this on trust, on sort of the things that Netanyahu basically trashed during his time on, like, the, trying to find consensus and healing and unity in Israeli society as best we can, right? That just can't be reconciled with what you see in the streets today, right? You couldn't do it. And in the end, Naftali Bennett's going to have to think, right, who am I, like, which side of those people am I on? And like, if I had to guess, and I, you know, this is one of those sound bites that I may look like an idiot. I think he actually, for both personal reasons and also self-interest reasons, will realize that he is on the side of, these people are not my people. In part because there's nothing he could possibly do at this point to win their votes. That's the self-interest argument, right? These people hate his guts. They were chanting racist chants while, you know, holding signs about how bad he is. He's never going to win them back, right? But also because, in a very unusual, like an odd way, and this is a much longer conversation about Naftali Bennett, who is a man of many contradictions. Naftali Bennett wants to be a conciliator. When he was the head of the settler council for a short period of time, one of the reasons he eventually lost that job is he went and showed up at Israel's 2011 social justice protests that were against inequality and tycoons and the high cost of living. This was a left-wing movement. And he showed up because he wanted to be in dialogue with those people. When Israel had protests against police abuse of the Ethiopian Jewish Israeli community, which has some parallels to some Black Lives Matter activism in America. Bennett, again, was like the right-wing member who showed up to start. He wants to bring these people together, but the question is does his conciliatory approach include the Arab community? And so far his government does, right? Yeah. So does that also include over more his broader political approach? And there are ways to be, and there have been in Israeli history, right-wing Israeli leaders and right-wing Israelis, like the outgoing president, Reuven Rivlin, right, who embrace the Israeli Arab community within a right-wing framework, right? That could be a more like, we want to have some sort of confederation with the Palestinians in the future, right? There are different approaches that are different from the two-state solution, for example, that see both populations living equally. And Bennett's gonna be, you know, faced with this choice. And the question will become, which will he choose? Of course, after 2 years, then we have Lapid, and we know which way he chooses. And so, yeah, so that's the next 4 years.
Yeah. Well, yeah, this is why I like talking with you, because, look, I think in Washington and around this set of issues in general, I think cynicism is often thought of as being smart or savvy. But, you know, there is this potential silver lining. There is reason to be hopeful here about a better future for Palestinians and Israeli people after Netanyahu is gone. So thank you for doing the show. Everyone check out yair.substack.com. Follow him on Twitter, Tablet Magazine. What else do we want to plug here?
That sounds like it. You know, my hope is that now that Yair Lapid is an international figure, people will finally learn how to pronounce my name. We can all work on that, but at least spelling it is.
How do they get it wrong? Do they call you Yair?
I mean, to be fair, it looks like air. So I become Yair, right? If I ever started a podcast, Fresh Yair is right off there.
Ooh, Fresh Yair. That's great. Trademark
that would just encourage all the wrong things. everyone will then mispronounce it forever. But, you know, we have a vested interest in Yairs who are not Yair Netanyahu. Don't Google him. Being the predominant Yair out there. So the Yair rankings have gone, you know, have been adjusted in our favor for now.
Well, congrats on that. And thank you again for doing the show. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Thanks again to Yair for joining the show. Ben, after this little chit chat of ours. We're going to hear an excerpt from your audiobook. So that is exciting. I would also love to know, you're in New York. You got big plans? You going to go to the museum? You going to do something fun?
Well, first of all, on the book, I would do want to say, like, I recorded it. I read it. And mainly because the main feedback I got, I didn't read my first book. And the main feedback I got from Worldos mainly when I was on like book tour on my first book was like, hey man, like, who's this actor reading your book? You know, like, which is a pretty good point. If like, I'm a podcaster, I should at least be able to read my book.
That's, okay. Fair.
Which I enjoyed doing. And this book, this gives you a little flavor of kind of the travel ethos of the book. It's a excerpt from the very beginning. Cool. But yeah, New York, I mean, I'm going to catch up with my parents, but like, it just opened here today, just like it did in California. So like, I'm thinking of going to a Mets game, like,
nice.
Like I'll be hitting all the hot playground spots in Central Park with my kids, like definitely hit up like a couple of the museums, see some friends I haven't seen in a while. It's going to feel like a normal life in
is
New York
Broadway
City.
Broadway
like,
open?
So Springsteen is the first one back. You know, he has his Broadway show. Like stuff is coming back here. It's super exciting to see, like, you know, New York, which I was once the epicenter of this whole pandemic, is now like feels almost normal.
That's cool. Well, have fun there. Good to see you, and we'll talk to you guys next week.
Cool. Thanks, guys. See ya.
Pod Save the World is a Crooked Media production. The executive producer is Michael Martinez. Our producer is Jordan Waller. It's mixed and edited by Andrew Chadwick. Kyle Seglin is our sound engineer. Thanks to our digital team, Elijah Cohn, Yale Freed, and Phoebe Bradford, who film and share our episodes as videos each week.
I walked aimlessly around the sprawling city of Yangon, a blanket of heavy heat over me, buying knockoff Nikes for a few bucks to make it easier on my feet. I went to a pagoda and sat staring at a Buddha, waiting to feel something. I walked into a U.S. government-funded library where I'd been a guest of honor a couple of years before. Now, anonymous to young Burmese buried in books and screens. Then I conducted workshops in the capital city of Naypyidaw to help the Myanmar negotiating team prepare, sharing lessons I'd learned while negotiating reconciliation between the United States and Cuba. The civilians took earnest, copious notes. The stern-faced military men in drab green uniforms wrote nothing down. Afterward, I joined a meeting with Aung San Suu Kyi, dissident turned state counselor, at her residence. For the first time in my several meetings with her, we were asked to take off our shoes inside the Buddhist home, a reminder of the Burmese Buddhist nationalism that had become more predominant in recent years. Within a matter of months, the Burmese military that had once imprisoned Suu Kyi would pursue a campaign of ethnic cleansing against a Muslim minority, the Rohingya. 1 million people were driven into neighboring Bangladesh. Through it all, Suu Kyi would remain silent. People wondered at her fall, from Nobel Peace Laureate of the early 90s to international pariah. But it made a certain kind of sad sense to me. A survivor from a country on the periphery of power in the world. She once surfed the wave of democracy that accompanied the end of the Cold War. She rocketed to international attention in 1989, the year that the Berlin Wall came down, by leading a democratic movement protesting the military government. By 2017, she was doing what she felt she needed to do to survive in a world where nationalism ran amok. Her own journey, from democracy icon to tacit collaborator in brutality fueled by Buddhist nationalism and rampant anti-Rohingya disinformation on Facebook, didn't cut against the currents of history. It drifted in the wake of events in the wider world. In April 2017, I went to Milan with Barack Obama. He was there to speak about climate change, a few weeks after Donald Trump pulled out of the Paris Climate Agreement. The rhythm of the trip felt familiar. A private plane, a block of hotel rooms, Secret Service agents. But the plane was a fraction the size of Air Force One. There were only a handful of hotel rooms and agents. And unlike the crush of responsibilities that used to follow me, I had very little to do. I accompanied Obama on a private tour of Leonardo da Vinci's drawings, peering down at bold lines that improbably anticipated the machines of the future. Helicopters and missiles, the machinery of war that we'd presided over for 8 years. Dusty volumes, hundreds of years old, lined the walls of the library. From human creations like this, the Renaissance had emerged, paving the way for the pursuit of scientific inquiry and cultivation of a more enlightened Western civilization that now felt under assault. Back at the hotel, throngs of Italians waited outside Obama's hotel. I told him that he remained the most popular politician in the world. No, he corrected me. I'm one of the biggest celebrities in the world now. He didn't mean it as a good thing. Progressive change, relegated to cultural celebrity.
Planet Fitness has everything you need to get stronger just around the corner, so you can give everything you've got. Whether you want to crush a few reps before class with our expanded strength equipment or sweat it out on your way home from work, with over 2,800 locations, there's a Planet Fitness close to you, and most are open 24 hours. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends January 30th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.
At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.